welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 414 for Wednesday, the 23rd of July, 2014. My name is Jim Race. I am here in Northern California with Harry Lloyd over in Oman, literally on the other side of the planet. How you doing, Harry?
Yeah, not too bad. For once, we're recording it about middle of the day my time, so I'll just give everyone a bit of a weather update. It's only 33 degrees Celsius currently in Oman, so it's a bit of a cold day. I think I'll have to put the heating on because it's a bit chilly. But otherwise it's all good. Yeah, just keep on keeping on, all that sort of stuff.
Cool. Well, you and Dave have been doing a stalwart job for the last few weeks. Well, I've been flailing about from habitat to habitat, and it's great to have a chance to chat with you again. I think the last time we did was prior to Laguna.
Yeah, it was a fair few weeks ago. But how was Laguna? We obviously haven't heard from you since you went to Laguna. How was that?
Laguna was very cool. Kind of quiet.
It seemed a bit quiet from some TV and Twitter images.
Yeah, it was quiet in the normal spectator areas, but the I think what happened was everybody. It's a dry lake, and if you ever go there, what you'll notice is that everything kind of focuses itself down into the paddock, and that's exactly what happened there. Everybody was down in the paddock because the paddock is quite open there. You have the opportunity to get down, walk around, and be in those areas, and that's essentially where all the fans were. So up on the hills where you would normally see a ton of people during, say, a GP or a massively attended race weekend, it was not that way. But once you got down into the paddock, oh man, it was shoulder to shoulder walking room only.
I think that happens at a fair few races. You know, the paddock always seems to fill up before the spectator stands. But it's good that there are at least some people there.
It was plenty crowded, and the one nice thing about that. For it not being overcrowded, if you will, is that it drops the pressure off the shoulder of the racers to sort of be performers, if you will, and lets them let their hair down, and you get the opportunity to mingle. And on top of that, the one thing that was very cool was I got to Jules was there. And it's rare that I get to hang out with him. So that was fun. That was very, very cool. On top of that, I got to camp, with a very new, cool friend of the show, a gentleman named Gerhardt. And I haven't camped at Laguna in 15 years. So, that was neat.
Nice. Sounds like it was a good weekend, and for World Superbikes, the racing was pretty exciting.
Race one was, you know, it was relatively normal-ish, if you will. Race two was a little bit off the charts as far as stop starts. Those of us in the media center, and there are obviously international lines and favoritism that go on, it got fairly loud.
I can imagine. Did you happen to see the Sylvan Barrier crash from anything more than on TV, or were you in the media center at that point?
I believe when that happened, I was just outside of pit lane on the other side of the garages, I heard the crowd noises, and I went running through a garage. I don't remember who was. I think it was an Aprilia garage. By the time I got out there, it was a red flag, and everything had been stopped. I saw it later on a couple of replays, but it was just odd.
Yeah, well, I was doing a bit of Twitter exploring the other day. And Sylvain Barrier had been blaming the crash on Christian Eden, saying that Eden touched his handlebars. But there was a very interesting photo, and I'll be sure to link to it in the show notes. And the photo was of Sylvain Barrier giving Christian Eden a good elbow to the stomach as they're going past on the home straight. So it sounds like there could be a bit more to that accident than initially meets the eye, and maybe a bit of a argy bargy.
One of my favorite terms.
Yeah, and it kind of brings up this other thing that we've discussed on the podcast before of the bimotors, obviously ridden by Christian Eden. They're currently not scoring points, but they're still able to affect races and affect racers in such a way, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, which is fine. I mean, they're not homologated yet. That being said, Jules and I were walking around the hot pits on, I think it was Friday or Saturday, and oh my God, what a piece of kit that bike! I mean, it's a bimota, and you know they're going to be beautiful. And this thing was torn down to kind of its barest essentials, if you will. The swing arm on that thing. Or swinging arm, to be more technical, was an absolute thing of beauty. I mean, okay, you know that you're a racing fan when you can look at something like that and kind of
appreciate weld lines.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I was like, oh my God, just like. I'm pretty sure it's actually cast, not made out of billet, which surprised me a little bit. And some Bimota people are probably going to send me an email and go, no, we milled that out of a single piece of aluminum. But just a beautiful, beautiful bike. You throw a rider on it and all that goes out the window. But very cool. I wish them luck. You know, the Ulsterra team, if you're racing and you're not racing for points, that's got to be frustrating, but you're still racing and you're racing at a top tier.
Yeah, and they have been doing a good job. I'm sure if they had been scoring points, both Christian Eden and Artin Badovini would be in the hunt for the lead of the Evo Championship.
Well, and the thing that actually, you know, I find encouraging is that they're doing it with such ferocity, without scoring points. What is your motivation? Well, okay, as a rider, obviously there's probably a few dollars involved, right? What drives you?
I guess it just is that the desire to win.
Yeah. Yep. Odd though. You have to admit it's a little bit odd.
Yeah, the whole situation is very weird. The whole thing and how they get removed from the stat, how they get taken out from their position and put on the bottom of the timesheets, but still finished. Yeah, I don't know. Whole situation's weird.
Yep. All right. What else do we have going on? I do want to thank those people that have subscribed to the show. Thank you very much. No new donators this week. But if you'd like to help support the show, you can do so by going to www.motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side of the page, about halfway down, there's a couple of yellow buttons. Feel free to click either of those and help keep the show going. and help keep me going for the time being. We did have a fair amount of listener feedback this week, and one of the ones, and very pleasantly insistent, and while I have responded to her, from Celeste Atkinson, she was inquiring about what to do for Indy, for MotoGP. And while I have replied to her, I will reply in a more general sense to everybody. If you're going to go to Indy for the MotoGP race, I would highly suggest that you buy yourself general admission tickets. Very inexpensive. There is a parking lot across the street that is a grass lot that is really cheap for the day. I don't know. It's like maybe $10, $15 at the most. You literally walk across the street and you're into the circuit in 20 minutes at most. And then to get out at the end of the day, you walk out through a designated stadium entrance and you're in your car and you're gone in 20 minutes. Traffic is non-existent to get out of that circuit. That being said, when you're there with general admission, you can get anywhere you want, but the place is so big. And Harry, I can't express to you how big it is. I mean, you can fit like 25, 30 football pitches inside. It's that big. And all inside of a big stadium complex. Bring good walking shoes because the circuit is quite well spread out. And there are things actually beyond the circuit itself that you might want to see. The first time you walk in there, I still remember it. I remember the first time I walked in there with Jules, and we were all kind of, our eyes just went boing. We were like, holy crap. If there is a place that you have an opportunity to go to at some point, try and make it there. I swear you will walk into that circuit and just be shocked. I mean, you know, imagine walking into, you know, a football stadium over in Europe and finding out there was a 4.5 mile race course there. You might be a little bit shocked. Yeah. So Celeste and anybody else is thinking of going to Indy, go. It's a once in a lifetime experience. And if you come back from that and don't enjoy it or do, of course, we'd love to hear your feedback. So, you can always get in touch with us by emailing to motopod@motopodcast.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yep, definitely. And, as most listeners who email in will know, you get a fair few responses when you email in, sometimes more than you'd wanted.
Yep, definitely true. We had another email, and why don't you start in the silly season, because I'm going to pull this one up.
Okay, so the first big thing of silly season is that both Andrea Iannone and Cal Crutchlow are staying at Ducati. This was announced during World Ducati Week, which they hold every year at the Simoncelli Misano circuit. And this came as a bit of a surprise to me, at least. I honestly thought that that at least one of the two factory Ducati boys would leave. I personally didn't think it would be a smart choice to leave, because the only real other option for either Dovi or Cal seemed to be going to Suzuki, and the Suzuki, you know, it's still developing. It hasn't raced a year yet. So I think that it would be as big a risk as staying with Ducati, but for less money. So why would you do that? But yeah, both Cal and Dovi will be with Ducati for another 2 years, and Cal will continue to see out the remaining year of his contract.
Cal was very polite. I was now that being said, I have to stop saying that. He was completely surrounded by what I think they said the attendance was something like 59,000 people.
Yeah, George Caddy Week gets one or two.
Yeah. Well, they've got an awful lot going on, although it was only 3 days this year. But he was super polite, seemed to be having a great time. But when you're surrounded by nearly 60,000 people that are all Ducati-based, you're going to be polite.
Hard not to be polite.
Yeah. Well, and it's clearly for the riders and the fans a ton of fun. They do the whole drag race thing. There's constant things going on. I want to go at some point. And I'm not even Ducatisti. I mean, if we were going to send anybody, we should send Jules because he's got several in the stable. But it just seems like, well, that and Vroom. I've always wanted to go to Vroom. Hello, Ducati, if you... if you ever want to bring Motopod to Italy, please feel free to drop me an email and bring me over. I would love to do that. That's the wintertime event prior to every season.
And also announced at World Ducati Week was that Andrea Iannone will also be staying with Ducati, but he'll be getting a full factory bike. So at the moment, Andrea Iannone is obviously racing for Pramac, and he has a factory bike and has almost all the factory support in the world. But it seems like next year he'll get even more factory support and may even be running the same full red livery as Cal and Dovi, while teammate Hernandez will be in just the probably white of Pramac. So Iannone is another one who had originally been saying that if he doesn't get a factory ride, he'll jump ship. But it looks like Ducati have managed to calm him down, probably by adding an extra zero to his contract.
Yeah. What is the difference between a factory bike and a factory bike?
I'm not sure, but this is what they said. To my knowledge, Iannone's bike is the exact same as Dovi or Cowles in everything but fairing color. So we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Perhaps like stippled paint, like a golf ball, you know, give you that little bit extra leverage. One other listener email before we continue on. And I really love this one. In fact, this is one of the ones that went into an extended conversation. This is from Peter Baines. I believe he's from Down Under. And it's a complimentary email to the show, but I thought it was very cool. Peter says, "Hi, guys. Two memorable quotes from the latest Harry and Dave show. Love your work, Dave. Pina coladas and shrunken testicles."
Yeah, there were one or two moments in that last show.
I was quite amused. He says, "I've been around bikes most of my life, apart from the obligatory timeout period when married life and kids intervene. I ride, and I say ride rather than race, a couple of historic bikes in local Australian historic class events. A 1972 Ducati 450 and a 1972 Honda CB350. Did you get the pictures of his Ducati?
Yeah. Those are very, very nice.
It was brilliant. In fact, Peter, I have posted one of those on the Motopod fan page on Facebook. By no means am I an aficionado of MotoGP or any other class of racing for that matter, but do enjoy the coverage. I've been listening to podcasts for a year or so now, and I implored him to go back and listen to older ones because they're brilliant. Thought it was time for some feedback. He doesn't really have any. He just wanted to say he appreciates the efforts. Speaking of the interviews, he did appreciate the effort Bill Hall puts in from the Island Classic, having been to the event as well as similar but smaller ones. I get a real sense of being there listening to his interviews, and I agree. Phil, when he takes the helm for us, does a brilliant job. Another point he made was another revelation for me was the recent interview with Mark Miller. I thought that was funny. I hadn't heard Mark before this, so my only point of reference for him were the frequent cheeky comments from Mr. Race, that being me. Now, obviously, Jim and Mark are mates, and that allows for the level of banter Jim's able to get away with. So I was probably expecting Mark to be a bit of a lad. But, and I mean this in a nicest possible way, I was pleasantly surprised by his interview. His comments were very incisive, considered, and well expressed. Anyway, that's it. Thank you, Peter, for writing in. Totally appreciate it. And I agree with everything you said, 110%. Very, very cool.
Super. Yeah. And it's always nice to get emails like that, you know?
And we appreciate the occasional pat on the back.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's nice.
We're not working in a vacuum, are we?
No, definitely not. But yeah, right. you can also get in touch with us on Twitter, at @moto_pod. And then there's also the Facebook page, which is MotoPod. So you can also leave comments, questions, praises, concerns, all that sort of jazz there.
The thing about Twitter is it's so instantaneous, but it's so fleeting.
Yeah. It can be, Twitter can be weird sometimes, but yeah. Weird in a good way. Anyway.
All right. Hang on for a moment. There we go. Okay. Now we can start the show.
So what are you drinking then?
This is actually a Negro Modelo.
That sounds very fancy.
It's Mexican beer.
All good. So moving back to news. Suzuki are the other big factory spot that's still a bit up in the air, but it seems like the factory seats at Suzuki will probably be occupied by Maverick Viñales and Alicia Spargo. The hive mind of Twitter had seemed to think that the announcement would be made either today or sometime very soon, but there hasn't been any word on it yet, so we're still waiting to see what happens on that one.
I think you need to patent that term, the hive mind of Twitter. it's very true. I think Viñales was kind of a surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, and apparently Viñales has signed a 3-year contract with Suzuki. But it kind of makes sense, you know? You're going to want one rider who's experienced to help develop the bike, but you also want a younger rider to learn how to ride that bike, how it wants to be ridden, and to try and push it towards the front and maybe take one or two more risks than perhaps someone like Alish would.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the hive mind of other places, if you will, had been speculating that is exactly what was going to happen. And did Suzuki have the cubic dollars to get in a talented top tier rider to do development as well as, you know, a young gun to push it to its absolute limits, and I think they pulled it off.
Yeah, and it'll be very interesting to see how Viñales does. Viñales is obviously managed by Aki Ayo, who also manages Jack Miller, and as we talked about last episode, the Jack Miller situation is very interesting.
I believe the term is fluid.
Yeah. So it'll be it's interesting to see Aki Ayo pushing so hard to get his two riders up into MotoGP so quickly, whereas you know before you might have seen a rider spend maybe 2 years in Moto2. It looks like Viñales is just going to spend one.
It's I think times are changing. It's very, very interesting to watch the potential transition, and this would not happen back in the days where we had four strokes in GP and two strokes down in lower classes. A potential jump from Moto3 to GP.
I guess from that we'll go to an update on the Jack Miller situation. It seems as though Jack Miller will potentially sign with LCR Honda on a 3-year deal, with the last year of that deal being with the Repsol Honda team, or at least on a factory bike. And yeah, Miller's kind of the real crux of this whole situation of, is it too much? And yeah, there's obviously a big difference between a Moto3 bike and a MotoGP bike, just in terms of speed and weight and things. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Miller in that regard.
If there's somebody that can pull it off with the audacity to do it, I think they picked the proper rider. Jack's got moxie, man. I mean, he seems like one that is willing to make the jump, and not from a I can do it. I guess it is from I can do it perspective. I look forward to seeing if he can pull it off.
Yeah, it'll be one of those things where it either makes his career or breaks it, and hopefully he makes it.
Well, if he was going to do that, he couldn't be going to a better team than LCR, because that is a super, super supportive team that dedicates themselves to the rider first and the bike second.
Yeah, the only other issue is that LCR, specifically Lucio Ceccanello, really wants to keep Stefan Bradl. And if Honda come in and say, no, you have to take this rider, I just wonder if there could be some underlying tension there.
I'm trying to think. Do we have any other Germans in GP right now?
Well, there was the rumor that Jonas Folger would move up to the Tech 3 squad, but now it's been announced that he will instead stay with his AGR racing team for another year in Moto 2. So Stefan Bradl is currently the only German.
So where do you think Stefan will land?
I think Stefan will land at NGM Forward.
Ah.
On a Forward Yamaha. I think that it'll be him and Bradley Smith there.
So it will be interesting to see what they pull out of the hat as far as factory support goes.
Yeah. I mean, Yamaha have already said that they're not going to give NGM the chassis again next year, so NGM have to make their own, and I think that will really hinder how that bike does, because so far every race and every qualifying lap this year Alesh has used the Yamaha chassis and has only used the NGM chassis occasionally in practice to test it out.
Well, I mean, considering that they've had that chassis in house and without being glib, they've had a little bit of opportunity to study it and try and put forth their best efforts into reproducing something that is as close to it as it can be.
Mm, yeah, much like Suzuki.
Yeah,
we'll have to wait and see how that goes, because it could go either way.
Yep. Carry on.
So the other big rumor. And we've kind of touched on this this before, is it's kind of a widely accepted fact that Aprilia are going to come back in 2016, but now it looks like they'll be instead coming back in 2015 as a factory squad. Obviously, Max Biaggi was testing for them at Mugello, so that kind of added some fuel to this fire. But it looks like Alvaro Bautista has signed for Aprilia for next year, and it also looks like his teammate could be Eugene Laverty, which is a very interesting move, because Laverty didn't leave World Superbikes with didn't leave the Aprilia World Superbike team with the happiest of times.
Yeah, the chat that we had at Laguna for the show was rather depressing.
Yeah, you could tell in your interview with him that he was not as upbeat.
Yeah. And which is odd, considering that he just came in fourth. Yeah, he didn't leave that team on the best of terms. That's putting it in the nicest way. And so I was a bit surprised when I heard that. You know, it's not a done deal yet.
No, but lots of people seem to think that we will be seeing that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, one of the, and we'll see. You know, the loss of Gigi, I think, actually changed the nature of that squad.
Yeah, that's another thing that people have been talking about. Is they're really interested to see how Aprilia does without Gigi at its head.
Yep, yep. All right, what else we got? Aleix got a little bit of a gig going.
Yeah, so currently Aleix Espargaró runs his own Moto3 team in the Sev Series. It has some long name that I can't remember off the top of my head. But it looks as though he's looking to pull a Valentino Rossi and bring his racing team over to Moto3 next year. It looks like he'll run Gabriel Rodrigo, his current rider, who has had one wild card and then also a replacement ride for Nicky Ayo. It looks like he'll be one of the two riders in that team next year, and the other riders yet to be decided. But they'll be running KTMs. And
You said Sub Series, which is about as deeply insider as you can get. What you meant
is the Spanish domestic series.
Yeah, CEB.
The AMA.
Yeah. So just so people know, I'd like to make sure that, because people go, what? What do you say? Carry on.
That's all that there is on the Aleix front. And as we mentioned earlier, Jonas Folger won't be going to the Tech 3 squad as was rumoured, but will instead be staying with his AGR team for another year and to try and compete for the Moto 2 title. It's obviously the AGR team's first year with a Kalex chassis. They ran speed ups last year. So it'll be interesting to see what they can do with another year of experience under their belt. Folger has impressed me a lot, and I think that he could challenge for the Moto 2 title next year.
He's streaky. He's one of those guys that will have a great couple of races and then you don't hear from him.
Yeah, he can run very very hot and cold.
Yeah. It's been interesting what we've been seeing lately on the national front. Across several nations, primarily out of the UK, and especially as we're kind of getting into the run-up to Suzuka, which we don't even have in the show notes, but we should probably have a bit of a chat about that. That being the 8 hours that we have every year. Josh Brooks says he wants to return to World Superbike. Well, duh. I don't think he had the best of weekends last weekend.
No, Brooks struggled a bit, as did a lot of the riders last weekend.
But that being Josh Waters got his first win.
Yep. So it was at the Brands Hatch circuit and the full Brands Hatch circuit.
Yeah, not the actual racing circuit.
Yeah, not the little merry-go-round that...
Which cracks me up because they call the little circuit the GP circuit.
No, that's the Indy circuit. The big one is the GP circuit.
The Indy circuit is basically a go-kart track.
Yeah, pretty much. Apparently it's because of noise restriction laws or something.
Lame.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why. But they obviously had the race there. The first race was pretty predictable. BSB, Shaky Byrne wins. I think he won. Sorry, it wasn't. Ryuichi Kiyonari, he won. So that race is actually a bit more exciting. I do apologize, Kiyo. But yeah, Kiyo has come back on form as of late, so that's been good to see.
And James Ellison was right up there as well.
Yep, James Ellison was also running towards the front. I think he finished third in race one, from memory, I think. But then in race two...
And Grandpa Chris Walker.
Yeah. Also, another interesting thing to note is that John Hopkins has come back 15 kilos lighter than when he first started the season. And that's a lot of weight, you know? Hopper can't weigh more than, what, 70 kilos at most?
He was looking a little portly at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, so yeah, he obviously needed to lose the weight.
Well, and he was flat out told that he needed to lose some weight.
Yeah. So it's good to see that Hopper's still obviously very dedicated to it. Because to lose 15 kilos, that's pretty intense.
Yep. And, you know, everybody has been marking him as the guy to run on the Suzuki MotoGP bike. I mean, because it's in his blood, right? I wouldn't be surprised if, certainly not next year for sure, but maybe the year after if we don't see him have a slot on that bike.
Really? You think that?
Yeah. I know Depunier is going to continue to be a test rider for them. Tell me you wouldn't find it fascinating to see Hopkins on the Suzuki MotoGP bike.
I mean, I'd love to see it. Hopper's one of my favorite riders, but I just think that, you know, he's struggling as it is in BSB, and he's unfortunately getting on in years for a racer. And I just think that I personally don't think we'll see him as anything more than a wild card or a test rider.
He's 31.
Yeah, but the problem is that he's been away from GP for so long, and there's now all these young kids that by being 31 you're not really competitive anymore.
Yeah, well, he's a beat up 31, if you will.
Yeah, he's definitely been through the wars one or two times.
Yeah. Where are we?
We're pretty much done with news, but since we're on BSB, we'll talk about race 2 in BSB, which was action-packed. So it started to rain a bit way through the race, but before it got red flagged, James Ellison unfortunately ran onto the grass, and because it was wet, had a massive high side.
Yeah.
I'm not too good with my BSB tracks, so I'm not sure which corner it was. I'm sure Dave's kind of yelling.
I believe it was Clearways.
Okay, that sounds familiar. So James Ellison had a massive high side, broke his femur, but he managed to get up and sit on hay bales before he realized that his femur was broken, which was pretty intense.
The part of it that broke, too, is the worst part. It broke the ball.
Yeah, that sounds complicated.
There were a lot of people that were speculating that he was fine. No. So it's kind of the remedy for that is basically, it's kind of like a hip replacement. James is no spring chicken. He's been on the show before. Love you, James. And wish you the best of luck in rehab. To get that thing fixed, that's going to be, to put it mildly, a bit of a pain. But love to see you back out there. You're a great addition to the paddock.
Yeah, hopefully he does return as quick as possible. But I think it was that femur that he broke before as well, because he was tweeting about having plates and screws removed for other plates and screws, which is
it's always nice to have new hardware.
I guess it is, yeah. Just maybe not. Screws.
Yeah, just consider it a rebuild, if you will.
Yeah. But yeah, and then as you mentioned, Josh Waters won the second BSB race that was in the wet, and he heads off to the Suzuka 8-Hour, which is this weekend.
And he's partnering with?
Josh Randy Ward. Yeah, he's with Depunier.
Randy Depunier, yeah. Yep, there's some great riders and great teams out there.
Two 200 riders, 70 teams starting the 8-Hour this year.
And on top of that, we've got a very, very seriously dedicated and currently in hardcore mode rider by the name of Kevin Schwantz, something like that.
I think I've heard his name before.
And he's not messing around this year. He's in it to win it.
Do you have any inside information on what Kevin's been up to in terms of training or?
He's up to trouble as usual. He's just been working really, really hard. A lot of bike riding, or push bike riding. A lot of training on the motorcycle. Mostly 600s, not thousands. I always love Suzuka because the bikes are so unique. And they're unique beyond what we normally see in the World Endurance Championship. The bikes that are kitted out for Suzuka are pretty much the epitome of hardcore endurance bikes. I mean, it's a spare no expense event, if you will. It's the showcase in every Japanese manufacturer's, you know, trophy case.
Yeah. I'm still here. That's why you see so many squads, and when you compare it's any of the, I think there's something like 24 Honda CBRs racing this year. They're obviously all a lot higher spec than even the World Superbike CBRs.
Well, the nice thing that you can do in a world endurance race is bring everything to the table. There are not very many rules. and I love that.
It's also interesting that most of the top teams, I think it's been every team, I think it's something like since 2006, has won the Suzuka on Bridgestone tires. As opposed to the Pirellis, which obviously World Superbike runs.
I did not know that.
Yep, I learned that from the Bridgestone Twitter account the other day.
Wow. Thank you, Harry.
No worries. it'll be interesting to see how the 8 hour goes. Unfortunately, there's no live stream of the race.
Yes, there is. There always is.
Okay, we'll see. But Wiggy-san, as we mentioned last week, he's compiled a whole bunch of information about the 8 hour, and that'll be provided in the show notes. So if you do want to watch practice or qualifying, all that is officially streamed, and the race will be, I'm sure, streamed somewhere slightly deeper and darker on the internet.
And I have to give a pat on the back to Wiggy-san. He's kind of an extraneous member of the Motopod family. He runs a group that Jules started back in the day on Google Plus. So if you go to Google Plus, type in motorcycle road racing, you'll find an awful lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah, so if Facebook isn't your flavor and Google Plus is more your flavor, you can check us out there.
We have some racing going on here in the States.
Yeah, I can't say I watched too much of that, so do you want to handle that? I saw that there was a very close finish in one of the races.
Oh, 1/1000th of a second, I believe it was.
That's pretty close.
Yeah. It literally was a hair finish. It was an interesting weekend at an interesting track. Mid-Ohio is a track that is renowned for being shit in the wet. I know, if you're going to be known for something, that is not something you would like to be known for. Saturday was essentially rained out, and the teams and riders got little to no practice as the rain was spitting off and on all through the day. There is a problem with the pavement in that there is a fair amount of what they call seedler down to kind of hold the track together. And the transitions from between the two are bad. I can't put it any other way. In fact, that's putting it rather nicely. And so there were a total over the race weekend of 7 races to be run, of which half were going to be run on Saturday, none of which happened. So we roll into Sunday, and they decide they're going to have 7 races on Sunday.
That's hectic.
That being said, the weather on Sunday was glorious, and they managed to pull the entire thing off. So a absolute tip of the Motopod hat to the AMA Pro Road Racing organizers for jamming all of that into a single race day. Absolutely incredible. I was impressed beyond words.
Oh, well, yeah, that's... they stream all of the AMA stuff live, don't they?
Yep, you can get it overseas, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I always see people talking about watching it, but I can't say that I've personally watched it before.
It's worth watching. I mean, if you're going to get free road racing, that being said, through www.fanschoice.tv, why not? You know, and it's high quality road racing. The coverage is excellent. Your hosts are great, with Barry Boone and Scott Russell, as well as Christy Lee and Daniel Teal down in the paddock. It's a it's definitely shall we say worth the money.
Maybe I'll do that with all this time on my hands, because I can't say I'm too knowledgeable about AMA, unfortunately.
It's some good stuff. As we all know, here in the States, the battle this year has been between Josh Hayes and Cameron Bobier, somebody who's probably destined for the GB paddock pretty soon. And it was definitely fun. The race you're referring to that was rather close was race 2. A back and forth battle. Cameron Bobier won race 1. Race 2, Cam, who is local to me, literally probably sleeping about, I don't know, wisely sleeping, that being almost 4 o'clock in the morning here, about 15 minutes away from me. I should go knock on his door. Dude, come on the show. Led almost all of race 2, and then Josh nipped him in the last lap, made a couple of mistakes after getting in front of him, and Cam nearly got him at the line, and literally it was a thousandth of a second. They had to go to a photo finish to try and figure it out, and it was close. It was damn close.
Huh. That seems a bit more exciting than even MotoGP at times.
Yeah. I remember as they rolled around on the cool off lap, Josh actually had to go into Parc Fermé, and that was where they told him that he won. He's like, really? Really? I won? So those are the kind of finishes that you appreciate.
Yeah, it did look incredibly close. It looked like a Moto 3 finish from the picture I saw on Twitter. But that's good that at least AMA has some good racing, because obviously AMA's struggled a teeny tiny bit with just everything, you know?
You're too nice. Well, there's only one round left this year, that being at New Jersey Motorsports Park, which is a pretty cool track. So there's 2 races, and that will determine the championship. Josh Hayes goes into it, I think, with a 45-point lead, so he's pretty comfortable.
That's pretty solid.
Yeah. He's pretty much just has to finish, although that is not in his makeup. So we'll have to see. What have we got coming up?
There's obviously the Suzuka 8-hour this weekend, and otherwise not too much, because most race series, certainly World Superbike and MotoGP, are on their summer break, so it's a bit quiet at the second.
Slackers.
I'm, I'm sure that the writers would agree with you on that one.
We've seen a plethora of pictures on the internet of people from the racing scene relaxing in various places. I've kind of been cracking up as I've been poking about and being like, oh man,
bit jealous.
We don't get a vacation like that. it should be cool. I'm really looking forward to Suzuka, and indeed, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a live stream. We don't advocate here at Motopod, illegal streams, if you will, wisely. But I'm pretty sure the ones that you can get online are not that way. If we find them, we will bring them to you. Look out for them on the Facebook fan page and see if you can't find a way to watch Suzuka. Now, that being said, if you have the patience to sit through an 8-hour endurance race, well, more power to you.
Yeah, so I can't really think of anything more that needs to be said. Do you have any more silly season gossip, or a bit too early / late for you to think of anything?
Yeah, it's 4:00 in the morning. No, I can't think so. Once again, thank you all out there for listening to the show. Much, much appreciated. And again, if you'd like to help support the show, go to www.motopodcast.com. Left-hand side of the page, a couple of yellow buttons. Feel free to click on either of them, and it'll walk you right through the process. I just want to thank you, or Mr. Producer. You actually have that title now. It's kind of frightening, isn't it?
I guess it is. Never known any different, though, so you know.
All right. And Dave, for carrying on in my absence. It's nice to be back. We may have an interview in this show. We may have to slip it in somewhere. I've been working on a few, and there may be one scheduled for this morning. Currently, it's 4:00 in the morning my time, and it's what time your time, Harry?
It's 3 p.m., so, yeah, pretty much, what's that, 11 hours difference? Maybe more, 13? Yeah. I don't know how time works.
You're almost on the opposite side of the planet.
Impressive.
I know, isn't it? Think about it.
We still managed to get this show together somehow.
How do you put out a radio show where your host is about it? Well, you know, talk about keeping it at arm's length, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure we could get much further. I guess it's just lucky I didn't visit Australia this holiday.
That was, from my time, I think it's like 16 hours ahead.
It would probably almost be easier because it just gets that point where it almost evens out.
Well, the discussions there are like, it's Sunday for you, right? I'm still on Saturday. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to Motopod once again. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Feel free to send us email at motopod@motopodcast.com. Tell us which a bunch of knuckleheads we are. Or send us something far more enlightening, because we love to get listener feedback, and we love to chat with you both on and offline through email. It's good stuff. We love it.
Definitely. So feel free to get in touch, and that's all for this week. So we'll see everyone later.
Okay. Ciao.
Bye.
The Temples of Speed, Episode 6, Scandinavia and the Rest. In this final instalment of the Temples of Speed, we take a whistle-stop tour around Europe and Scandinavia, where, despite Denmark being one of the founding members of the original FICM in 1904, they never held a Grand Prix. Sweden and Finland, however, were fairly active with a combination of road and permanent circuits between 1958 and 1990. Though many were in use from the 1920s, and it's Sweden where we start, in 1958 at Hedemora, around 100 miles northwest of Stockholm. You can imagine, over 55 years ago, the effort it would have taken to haul the Continental Circus up there. But this 4.5-mile, narrow, fast gallop around each side of a huge forest held their only GP there. Hedemora is a city, but a small one with just over 7,500 inhabitants back in the day. Holding four classes, the Italian double of Grandiozzi and a Ducati won the 125 race. Repeating this, Tarquinio Provini's MV was triumphant in the 250s, and although Jeff Duke's Nortons won both the 350 and 500 races, John Surtees had been totally dominant that year, winning both classes in the first four races of the season. At this time, your best four results were taken for the championship, so Surtees was already a double champion before Sweden, with three rounds remaining, so didn't compete, taking his then title tally to three. Two further successive doubles brought his final haul to seven in 5 years, before going on to win the Formula One title. Mists of time can erode the significance, but there are many people still out there that believe John Surtees to be the greatest of all time, an argument I will not take on here. So, quickest lap of the day went to Duke at 105 miles per hour. Quite a feat on this tight, mainly in shadow venue that remained operational until 1990 with a revival parade 8 years later. Sadly, there doesn't seem to be much to see here now, though you can trace the circuit online should you wish. In 1959, Kristianstad, a fairly featureless, almost square road circuit down in the south of Sweden, hosted 125, 250 and 350 classes won by Provini, Hocking and Surtees respectively, John Surtees clinching his third 350 title here in a year when he won all six races. There were no GPs here in 1960, and in 1961 the 500s were added to a vastly expanded 10 round season that even went to Argentina. Imagine doing that today. Winners that year were, from 125 to 500, Taveri, Hailwood on his way to his first title, Frank Astatsny on his Jawa, and finally, Gary Hocking, winning the Blue Ribbon class that year on a combination of Norton and MV. And that was it, except for one or two high-profile sports car racing. Top-level racing left Kristianstad. There is an FIA standard kart circuit there now, no relation though. Maybe Kristianstad's only claim to fame was that this was where Ernst Degner defected from East to West Germany, taking MZ's two-stroke secrets with him to Suzuki in 1961. So, off to Finland in 1962 and to Tampere. This road circuit had been in use since the 1930s, hosting their own unofficial Grand Prix until they got the real thing, but only for two seasons. Racing up and down the town's focal point, the Painikki Observation Tower, this was a tight, urban street track, not liked by everyone, though Mike Hailwood did, winning the 350 and 500 races in its final year of 1963. Strangely, all solo classes except 250s ran there, and the circuit finally returned to urban use only in 1971. Bike fans still flocked there, but only for the round of a World Speedway Championship. From 1964, uninterrupted until 1982, another road race circuit, Imatra, ran the Finnish Grand Prix. Situated 150 miles east of Tampere, this was an oblong run around lightly suburban roads. It was here that a debut in Kenny Roberts stood looking incredulous at the railway crossing he would soon have to bounce over. You can say eras aren't comparable, but this bristly Yank attempted both the 250 and 500 classes in his first year of 1978, only dropping the smaller bikes whilst well positioned due to his incredible workload of being Goodyear's only tyre development rider for motorcycle racing bikes at that level. He only had one 500 machine, and he had to grapple with circuits like this, the Nürburgring and similar. Means, quite simply, in my opinion, there can only ever be one best rookie in this humble author's eyes. Anyway, it was also here that a never mischievous Barry Sheen, appalled by the disgusting condition of the sanitary facilities that consisted of open stalls with holes cut into planks to drop your contents plopping into the lake below, decided to set fire to them. A popular decision in most competitors' opinion. Whilst all the big stars won here, and the hospitality and atmosphere was enjoyed, the tree-lined track, coupled with the awful paddock and hygiene facilities, were causing concern amongst an increasingly vocal riders' movement. After Marco Lucchinelli's win to wrap up his title in 1981, the riders told the FIM the 500s would not race the following year. They didn't, but all other classes did, and in torrential rain. And it was here that the 1980 World Sidecar Champion, popular Scott Jock Taylor, crashed and was hit by another aquaplaning outfit as Marshall struggled to free him, sustaining injuries from which he never recovered. The 500s approached, but never exceeded 100 miles per hour laps here, though looking at it, even that was amazing. Grand Prix never returned to Imatra, or to the Long Brno circuit, come to think of it, after 1982. More of that later, as the last of the pure road racers disappeared from the Grand Prix calendars forever. Back to Sweden, and from 1971 through to 1990, with only 78 and 79 being the exceptions, the Grand Prix circus arrived in the Swedish South Midlands of Anderstorp. Compared to most Scandinavian venues, Anderstorp had decent facilities, track surface and infrastructure. Unfortunately, organisation was generally poor, as was the crowd attendance. Still, due to many Swedish Grand Prix being the last of the season, there was always plenty of drama. Sheen won his last race here, and stories of the hospitality he allegedly received in the paddock from his female fans have passed into legend. Many Americans duked it out for the title here, and champions were slung into the outdoor swimming pool, especially the likes of Lawson and Spencer. Part of the circuit was used as a landing strip, and despite one longish straight, the 100 miles per hour lap was never cracked, with Rainey's first title year and last Swedish Grand Prix year producing a record of just below 99 miles per hour, this being in 1990. Anderstorp is still there, and domestically at least, seems to still be a notable venue for many types of motorsport in Sweden. In 1978 and 1979, the FIM decided to try another venue, Karlskoga, on the west and opposite side to Stockholm, in an attempt to attract bigger crowds and make the Swedish Grand Prix financially viable. This was Robert's first full season in 78, and this was one of the circuits he was particularly vocal about. Next to a gravel factory, Karlskoga was viewed by the circus as only fit for national racing, a slow, twisty, bumpy place that rewarded rider skill. Sheen won both 500 Grand Prix here, but the trip, one that left many riders out of pocket, crowds that remained low, and dubious organisation, meant these were the only two events held here. It's still there, but guess what? It only hosts national racers. Let's go over to Eastern Europe and two more road circuits that were legendary in their day but eventually were left out of time and melted into history. You'll all know Brno in the south of the Czech Republic, a wide circuit with vast elevations and lots of passing opportunities in a beautiful setting, really one to visit. However, that Brno has only been in existence since 1987, that's from 1930 until its 500cc demise in 77 and total closure in 82. The Masaryk circuit, as it was known, began life as an 18-mile monster that still surrounds the current purpose-built track in the Moravian countryside. Brno was a park-cobbled high-speed charge through various villages, Brno City and flat-out country, with some superb corners and serious drops and climbs that gradually reduced in length over the years to around 7 miles, but still remained a dauntingly fast challenge, a stern test for both cars and bikes. The worthy Dutch website Circuits of the Past has some excellent modern photos of this legendary street circuit. And if you're lucky enough to visit the current track, check out the original twin control towers and pit lane on the blast out of the city and into the country where Halewood, Ago, Reed, Saarinen and finally Didier de Rodriguez proved their mettle. Johnny Cecotto holds the 500cc record on his Yamaha from the final big race in 1977 at a dizzying 115.94 miles per hour, whilst Belgian de Rodriguez brought the curtain down in 82 on his 350 Chevalier Yamaha at 108.58 miles per hour. If you ever take a trip around the Masaryk, you'll realise this was an amazing feat. If we travel south from Brno, through Austria and Slovenia, we'll hit the beach of a charming resort in Croatia on the Adriatic coastline called Apatija. Unspoilt and clean, there's little to give away the fact that this place was known as the Monaco of the Continental Circus for its glamorous setting where, from 1969, when Godfrey Nash took a Norton to the last 500 GP victory by a British bike, to 1977, this was the venue for the Yugoslavian Grand Prix. Many riders arrived a week before and stayed until a week after if they could, as beautiful weather, sandy beaches, and cheap, plentiful food and drink took their minds off this 3.7-mile track, half of which snaked around the coast road of a classy yet faded resort that had witnessed much upheaval, being once Yugoslavian, then under Mussolini's fascist rule, before in later years becoming the vanguard of the Croatian tourist boom. Lined by thousands of straw bales, it was clear they were only of limited use in protecting any fallen riders, and there were numerous immovable objects lying in wait. Not only that, there was a terrifying final right-hander onto the start and finish straight, reminiscent of Silverstone's last corner, Woodcote, back in the Robertson Sheen era, but this one was much tighter, with no runoff. Preluk, as the locals called it, was revered for its location, but feared for the rest, and in 1973, many manufacturers either boycotted or scaled down their efforts. In 1974, British privateer Billy Nelson died there, and 1977 proved to be the end, as the deaths of Italian 250 rider Giovanni Gigiotto and 50cc pilot Ulrich Graf ensured the GP moved to a new purpose-built place, Rijeka. Brutal civil war meant the circus left this area after the 1990 Grand Prix, never to return. Britain's Chas Mortimer won at Opetija, and Germany's Dieter Braun was a multiple victor, whilst Takazumi Katayama's 350 Yamaha just cracked a 100 miles per hour lap, which was 11 seconds quicker than the fastest 500 lap set in 1973, the final year they competed. This was set by Kiwi Kim Newcombe riding his Koenig, which was powered by a marine engine. Amazingly, this combination was run up to Phil Reed in the title chase, and a poignant tale that is beautifully, yet sadly told in the Super 8 footage that his wife Janine shot around the world and was unreleased on DVD in 2006. Oh, and if you see a Koenig at any revival events, take some ear defenders. They wail like banshees. Look at some of the footage of Opetija that still exists out there, and you'll realise what a feat a 100-mile-an-hour lap must have been. It still looks a nice place to go for a summer break, and those roads are still there. Go on. The wife will never know the real reason. We're going to drop in on three more countries that were involved right at the start of our Grand Prix Championship history, and we'll start in Switzerland, where a 4.5-mile road and parkland circuit, Bremgarten, northwest of Bern, hosted 5 out of the 6 years of the Swiss Grand Prix. It was seen as a pretty but unforgiving track, well attended by the Swiss public, where top-level racing on 2 and 4 wheels had been enjoyed here since the 1920s. Despite riders of various nationalities winning the 250 classes on a variety of Benellis, Guzzis and others, British riders totally dominated all 10 bigger class wins, with Les Graham topping it with 4, whilst Fergus Anderson and Jeff Duke tied on 3 each, Duke being the first multiple champion of those formative years. Bremgarten was regarded as a true classic GP by both bike and car fans, rural in character but near the city, part cobbled, running past a sawmill and dense forest punctuated with picturesque Swiss scenery. However, tragedy was a feature here, as Omobono Tenni died here in 1948. Tenni was the first Italian to win a TT, was a multiple Italian champion and darling of the Guzzi factory, for whom he won almost 50 races. The spot where he died was named after him, but in a cruel coincidence, in 1952, both Ercole Frigerio, 3 times runner-up in the World Sidecar Championship, and Norton Works rider Dave Bennett both perished in 1952 at the Tenni Turn. The Car Grand Prix saw numerous fatalities of both drivers and spectators, one a young boy, and the most notable was one of the four-wheel legends of the time, Achille Varzi. Bremgarten wasn't slow, with Duke's Gilera approaching 95 miles per hour in the early 50s. For 1 year only, Geneva hosted the Grand Prix. This oddly shaped 3.7-mile track ran between the city's Nations Square and the late Geneva shoreline. I had to get that one in, rock fans. And on the day was a combined car and bike Grand Prix. Imagine that now. The bikes passed off relatively quietly, Umberto Massetti's Gilera winning the 500 race and ultimately that year's title. It was the later car race that was to prove fateful when Luigi Villarezzi crashed on the oil of Alberto Ascari and cleared a barrier, killing 3 spectators. Villarezzi survived, but the Swiss authorities were becoming nervous. And when 80 people were killed in the Le Mans tragedy of 1955, Switzerland banned all forms of motorsport in 1958, with only hill climbs surviving. The lower house of the parliament controversially reversed this ruling in 2007, but 2 years later the more powerful upper house reinstated the law, and nothing has changed since. down to Spain, and situated high on a hill overlooking Barcelona Harbour, is the grand setting of Montjuïc Park, where, from the 1950s through to the mid-70s, the motorcycle Grand Prix featured. This was no ordinary park, though, festooned with beautiful architecture and dominant Franco-inspired buildings mixed in with assorted stadia built for the 1992 Olympics. Before this park, there was a bigger version of it used for cars only in the 30s and 40s, and the still there crumbling banked oval of Sitges Terramar inland, but the bikes only ran at Montjuïc Park from 1951. From 1969, Montjuïc Park alternated with the permanent Jarama circuit until the end of Grand Prix there in 1976. However, the 500s finished here in 1972, with Britain's Chas Mortimer winning on his twin-cylinder Yamaha on his way to sixth in that year's World Championship. Chas's record is often overlooked, but he remains the only rider to have won Grand Prix in 125, 250, 350, 500 and 750 classes. The outright lap record is held by Franco Uncini, taking his 350 Yamaha on a lap of 1 minute 42.3, that being 82.7 miles per hour. Like some other circuits of the day, their tight and twisty nature was characterised by smaller machines often being quicker than 500s, not long after the 500s stopped running at these places. The gruelling 24 hours of Montjuïc endurance race continued to be held there until 1986, with the quality of both machines and riders underlining how highly the race was regarded by the manufacturers of the day, and it did have some glorious Formula One races here. In fact, when a prominent car magazine celebrated Formula One's 50-year history, Montjuïc Park was voted in their top 10, though possibly more for its glamorous Monaco-style setting than the challenge of the races themselves. In 1975, its car fate was effectively sealed when Emerson Fittipaldi boycotted after practice, citing many safety issues. And this was underlined in the race when the Embassy Lola Hill of Ralph Stommelen left the track, killing five spectators and seriously injuring himself. The place was forgotten as a race venue until the authorities decided to lay a plaque and mark out the circuit in 2004. And here's another place where revivals are becoming increasingly popular, attracting ever more stars on both two and four wheels. Montjuïc Park is very much intact, and next time you visit the superb Montmeló circuit for the Grand Prix de Catalunya, be sure to go up the hill to trace this historic park. You'll also get brilliant views over Barcelona. We'll leave mainland Europe to hop across two seas and onto Northern Ireland, where from 1922 a 20-mile road circuit with an incredible 7-mile straight was used, lacing together the B39, A52 and A26. This was the Clady circuit in County Antrim and was on the original 1949 calendar, though by then it had been slightly shortened to only 16.64 miles. Only. These bumpy roads, punishing on machines, were hosting unofficial Grand Prix well before the series kicked off, with Dorino Serafini's Gilera holding the long record at a whisker over 100 miles per hour, this in 1939, while the short, of course short being almost 17 miles, record was held by the MV Augusta of Les Graham at 105.7 miles per hour, set during the 1952 Ulster Grand Prix when the Clady track bowed out. That 500cc race was run over 15 laps, which was a withering 247 miles. Thankfully, these distances started to reduce slightly soon after, though not by much, as the Ulster moved to the nearby Dundrod circuit, where it remained in the FIM Grand Prix calendar until 1971. In 1953, it was run over 30 laps, or 221 miles, and was won by Aussie Ken Kavanagh on a Norton, also sharing the lap record with that year's champion Jeff Duke at 91.53 miles per hour. The last Grand Prix was run in 1971 and was exactly half the original distance and won by another Aussie, the legendary privateer Jack Findlay, on his Giada, which he built with Italian Daniele Fontana to house his 500cc Suzuki twin. After Sealy frames, this was one of the increasing options to make fast Japanese engines go around corners, and while it was light, that cost him a certain TT win when one of the frame tubes broke. Jack closed the Ulster at 96.78 miles per hour, though Ago held the outright record at 107.42 miles per hour in 1969. There were some notable highlights here. In 1959, Mike Held won his first Grand Prix, the 125 race, on a Ducati, and in 1963, he broke the 100 miles per hour van barrier on his private MV Augusta. Despite losing its place in the Grand Prix calendar, the FIM granted Ulster the right to remain to retain its Grand Prix title, though in 1972 the meeting was cancelled as a result of the political unrest the previous October, when the organisers' Grand Prix house was damaged from a terrorist-planted bomb. The FIM granted Ulster a round of the fledgling TT Formula One Championship, which it held from 1978 to 1990. Tragedy struck the very first year when both John Williams and Jeremy Swan died, though homeboy Tom Herron was a popular victor. In 1979, Joey Dunlop won the first of his record 24 victories, clinching Formula One titles here in both 1982 and 83. In 1987, Virginio Ferrari completed a few laps in practice before deciding the place was simply too dangerous and flying home. The race was started in horrendous conditions, and German Klaus Klein was killed at the end of the first lap. In 1989, Foggy claimed the Formula One title here, and this little talk about Joey and brother Robert's famous duel in 1990, Joey's Honda triumphing over Robert's JPS Norton. Today, like many road racers in Ireland, the popularity of the Ulster remains high, and they proudly promote the event as the world's fastest road race, due to Kiwi Bruce Anstey's lap in 2010 of 133.975 on a TAS Taz Suzuki. Though the TT is catching up, and this year, 2014, the very same Bruce Anstey took his Fireblade around the 37¾ miles in 17 minutes, 6 seconds, or 132.298 miles per hour. Mind you, neither have yet reached Baz's 137 miles per hour benchmark set over 35 years ago at Spa, but as these temples of speed fade into history, it's fitting we still finish with the Ulster, still flourishing, and of course, Mona's Isle, seen by many as the ultimate test of man and machine. There have been millions of words written and spoken about the island, so it's pointless me trying to add anything original here, but despite the ever higher costs of visiting the TT due to increasing commercialism and corporate demands, the festival, after some very lean years, continues to grow, and the recently launched Classic event is also beginning to bring larger rider and spectator support as we clamour to see the older machines featured in our moto history, ridden by the surviving legends, or by our modern day gladiators in their original settings. So, our collective TVs, sofas and waistlines get ever bigger as we continue to retire from any form of excitement or risk, save the things we can see through a screen. There's a quiet renaissance going on as some of us, particularly those who choose to ride motorcycles, assert our right to rise to the ultimate challenge. For some, the price is worth paying. So, thank heavens for those people. Thank heavens for those machines. And thank heavens for those temples of speed. Gone, though not forgotten. But some haven't gone anywhere. They're still here. Make sure you pay them a visit sometime. Bye for now.